Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Jamie Bologna.
By eroding or reversing Roe v. Wade, I think it'll create a kind of tension, a kind of anger, a kind of explosion that we don't fully appreciate.
This is former Governor of Vermont Madeleine May Kunin in 1991, testifying during the confirmation hearings for Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas.
And to push the clock back, I think we'll create an eternal battlefield that will be very, very painful.
I think we are on a battlefield, and I think it's very detrimental, not only for women, but for society as a whole.
That last clip is Kunin today in 2019. As some states put restrictions on abortions, this week Vermont joined states going the other way, protecting the right to choose. Madeleine May Kunin has been on the front lines of important issues for decades. Kunin is now 85, and she's out with a memoir, Coming of Age, My Journey to the 80s. She fled Nazi Europe for America and has had an incredible career here. Governor of Vermont, ambassador to Switzerland, deputy secretary of education in Washington, author, feminist, mother, wife, immigrant. And she talked about how it feels to add former to some of those titles.
Well, the former is still present in my experience, you know, in creating the person I am today. It has shaped me. So I still consider myself to be a feminist, to be have the experience of having been a governor and ambassador. And now I have a new title, which I enjoy, and that is author and poet. And being a former whatever gives you a certain freedom. When you're in public life, you have to be more careful. So with my book, Coming of Age, I felt almost liberated at the age of 85. And I enjoy my new title just as much as I did the old ones.
Well, you mentioned your book. It's Coming of Age, My Journey to the 80s. And I'm struck by that subtitle, to the 80s. That journey isn't over. As you said, you're 85 now. You're well into your 80s.
Right. In the book, I tried to describe how it feels to be in the 80s, how as an old person, I'm tempted to say older, but I really should say old. We still shy away from that kind of language. I have some distance from my life's experience, and I feel I can be more forthright. I don't have to be so cautious.
It also seems like you're coming face to face with your reality. I mean, there's a picture of you right on the cover, and there you are in your full glory. And in the first sentences of your book, you say, "Death's black raven perches on my shoulder from time to time. Even when he flies away, I know he is in the neighborhood." That's not something you see in a book every day.
I guess not. I mean, you can't help but think about death. You can't let it dominate your thoughts, otherwise you don't have any fun anymore. But when you're 85, you don't think in five-year terms or 10-year terms. What will you do then? You think in ones or twos or threes. And you know, my husband and I talked about carpe diem, live for the moment, live for the day. And that's what we have to do.
So, Governor, you mentioned your husband, John, and he died last year, and I'm sorry for your loss. He's a very integral part of this story. It's very much a love story in your book. And I guess I'm wondering, in the year since his death, how you've handled his loss.
Well, in a way, it seems more real now than it did a year ago. I think that's true for a lot of people who lose a loved one. You sort of think more about the things you did together and the things you can't do anymore. The thing I miss most, I guess, is showing him my writing. He always read everything. And he read most of this book. So it's still a loss, but you can cope with it. I don't want to sit in a rocking chair and just watch the world go by. I still want to be involved as much as I can.
I'm wondering how you think we've gotten it wrong in regards to how we think about and treat aging Americans, and maybe if you have a message to younger people.
Well, I think we see the aged as a problem that's going to break the bank financially to support the elderly. I mean, sometimes in articles when they talk about the aging American population, world population, I've seen the word tsunami, that we're going to be overrun. And sometimes the aging or the elderly are simply ignored. I think particularly as women, we're aware of that. People just don't see us. People just dismiss the aging as not being interesting. But advice is hard to give, though it is sometimes sought. I think just treat the elderly like people, like you would anybody else, and ask them questions and share your own thoughts, because we're very curious about young people. So just to keep connected with life, if possible, just lead as healthy and basic a life as you can and stay in touch.
That's beautiful. You make this very clear in your book that there's a double standard when it comes to men and women in terms of aging. How have you seen that in your career?
Oh, wow, that's a big question. I think as the first woman in any venue, you're watched. You know, can you do this? Can you do the job as it's been held by men forever? And so when I was elected governor, I think I was scrutinized in a way that another man would not have been. You have to be more conscious of things that are small, like how you dress. And, of course, we're seeing this in the candidates for the Democratic nomination for president. The whole question of likability has come out in the news. Women have to be both feminine and masculine. Masculine enough to hold the job like it's always been carried out, tough enough to be commander-in-chief, but then also warm and cuddly and likable. And, of course, Hillary was the key character of that dilemma. She was taken apart no matter what she did. It couldn't be quite right. But the exciting news is that there are four or five women running for presidents.
At least by my count, I have around six right now.
All right. I don't want to lose any of them. So the women are still saying, I'm going to get out there and do it. I'm not going to be scared off and pushed off the podium just because I'm female. So hopefully we get to a point where we say, I'm going to judge this candidate for what she stands for, not whether she wears a red jacket or a white jacket.
Well, I'm glad you brought up women in politics, because I was reminded so starkly by your positions during that Senate Judiciary Committee hearing on Clarence Thomas in 1991, because you sat there with a panel of other female activists, and you said this to the panel of male senators before you.
Once again, when it comes to our issues, we find ourselves repeating the ancient cycle of helplessness that women have experienced throughout history. The sense of powerlessness is painful. It is apparent right here in this room, where women are not equally represented in the decision-making process of this country. We are put in the position of pleaders, asking you to ask our questions for us, to be our stand-ins, to intercede on our behalf.
And now here we are in 2019, almost three decades after you said that. And the House is the most heavily female in history, and there are 25 female U.S. senators. Are you hopeful for the next election cycle?
I have to be hopeful, but, you know, when you play that clip, I really did feel anger that we were the pleaders, we were the outsiders, we had to ask them for the favor of listening to our cause. And yes, I am hopeful, but the question is, who is on the committees that make the decisions? We need more than just partial representation. We need to get to half and half, 50% women.
So I know it's the early days of the 2020 race, but at least as of now, former Vice President Joe Biden is leading in many of the polls, and I'm just wondering what you make of that.
Well, I'm glad he's changed. I'm glad that he sees the errors of his earlier days. The worst part of that hearing in that period was that they didn't believe the accusations.
And you mean, of course, Anita Hill and the hearing of Clarence Thomas.
Yes, and she was almost made fun of, and that was just outrageous.
And, of course, Biden has been reconciling with some of his past behavior and perhaps his inappropriate touching of women. And in your book, you write about your own experiences with comments and kissing and the way men treated you through the years. In a sort of post-Me Too era, are you encouraged by these societal changes on this front?
Yes. I mean, we're saying things out loud that we didn't say out loud before. If we did, we just confided to a friend. We would have sort of the secret life where we could confide in one another. It's now out there in the public arena. So some people say, well, maybe it's not fair to men. Maybe we're accusing them unfairly. But I think what we've really created is a forum for discussion about sexual harassment. And the consequences of that discussion are real. So it's a bright day.
And Governor Cunin, you also served in the Clinton administration. And I'm also just wondering if you think differently about his behavior with women through the years.
Well, it was a shock when everything came out, but I'm afraid I was a very strong Clinton supporter, so I probably didn't react with as much outrage as would have been appropriate. And yes, it was, as we like to say, complicated. You can't come up with a totally good answer. It was abhorrent what he did, but he seemed to reconcile some of us by the kind of president he was.
Another moment in your book that really struck me was when you write about the important role of the ladies' room in your political career as a place to cry.
Yes, in Vermont, it's a citizen legislature, so we don't have our own offices. There's no place to go and be private except maybe out the door. So the ladies' room becomes, when necessary, the crying room where you can just say what you think and let go. You sort of have to keep your sanity because you don't want to cry in public. That's the long-standing taboo for women, and crying is a sign of weakness. Now, when men cry, it's almost a sign of strength. But I did cry in the ladies' room, and I walked out feeling better.
I'm wondering if some of these qualities as a leader, as a mother, came from your own mother. And I was wondering if you could tell me about what she was like.
Well, she was a strong woman, and I'm more aware of her strength now when I'm older. My father died when I was 2 1/2. So in today's vernacular, she was a single parent. And she was bringing up me and my brother. And we came to America not speaking much English. And she made her way. And she also instilled in us certain values. She was very patriotic. In America, anything is possible. That's what she taught the two of us. And that's what we believed in.
And then later, when you became ambassador to Switzerland, your native Switzerland, I'm curious if you could tell us about the importance of reconnecting to your Swiss roots.
Well, it was a wonderful round trip, leaving Switzerland in 1940 at the outbreak of World War II and coming to America. And my mother never dreamt, and I never dreamt, of course, that someday I'd come back as the American ambassador. It was a lovely homecoming. The only flaw in the story is that the big issue facing me in Switzerland as an ambassador was the role of Switzerland during World War II, and the Swiss banks had been a receptacle for money from Jews who wanted to deposit their funds in a safe place. And after the war, when either the heirs of those who were killed or survivors wanted to get their money back, the banks had a very hard time letting anybody in. So when I was ambassador, part of my job was to retrieve those funds to the rightful owners.
And you face some anti-Semitism because of that, right?
I don't know if it was because of that. It was subtle anti-Semitism. I mean, nobody came up to me and said, you know, I don't like Jews. It was just that I was identified as a Jew, which in America I never was. You know, I wasn't the Jewish governor. It just wasn't an important question on my resume. But I also had a reunion with some of my Swiss cousins, and I felt I had a purpose as an ambassador. And to retrieve those funds was a wonderful cause. I didn't solve it completely, but we made an important first step in bringing back some of the funds. And then I had a moment of identification when the Swiss banks published the accounts that they couldn't identify, and my mother's name was on that. And all of a sudden, I became part of the story. But it turned out when everything was settled, the account turned out to be $150, which I shared with my brother.
Wow, that's an amazing story. Governor Cunin, I'm wondering about Vermont. Are there developments in Vermont today that both worry you and maybe ones that make you happy?
I think what worries me is that parts of the state are prospering and doing very well, like Chittenden County. And other parts of the state, the more rural parts and some cities, are having a hard time. And we'd like to be more attractive to young people, finding the delights of living in Vermont. And we still have to protect our gorgeous landscape and our farms. We're losing a lot of farms. People would like to live in Vermont, but they have to have a job. So we still have to do more to attract young people and keep them here so they want to raise a family.
Looking back on your amazing life, your career, is there anything that you would have done differently?
Oh, wow. When I graduated from Columbia School of Journalism, my dream job was to work for the Washington Post or the New York Times. So I never got to either one, except I did get to the New York Times when the editorial board wanted to interview me. And I went to the New York Times building, and I was with my state trooper who was in civilian clothes. And we knocked on the door, and their security person came up, looked at my trooper, shook his hand, and said, "Welcome to the Times, Governor." So I did make it to the New York Times after all.
Finally, Governor Cunin, how would you like to be remembered, perhaps the Cunin legacy?
I don't think in terms of the Cunin legacy, because life changes so much. I think you have to live for the present. I guess I'd just like to be known as a good human being, somebody who cared about the state, loved the state, and tried to improve the lives of the people who live in it. And whatever small or big steps that happened in my administration had a part in that. But we don't know for how long or how much. And just feel happy that I had the chance to be governor of the state. I mean, I wasn't a likely candidate. I was a woman. I was Jewish. I didn't have a business background. But somehow the people of Vermont trusted me.
Well, that sounds like a pretty good legacy to me.
Thank you so much.
Madeline May Cunin is a professor at large at the University of Vermont. She's founder of the group Emerge Vermont, a former U.S. ambassador to Switzerland and former governor of Vermont. Her memoir is Coming of Age, My Journey to the 80s. Governor Cunin, it's been a true honor. Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to me. Thank you so much.
And that's our show for today and this week. Radio Boston is produced by Zoe Mitchell, Chris Siderick, Paris Alston, and Walter Wolfman. Tim Skog is our technical director. Our executive producer is Hitesh Hathi. I'm Jamie Bologna, and I hope you all have a lovely Memorial Day weekend and join us again on Monday for more Radio Boston.